From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, a look at the historical and future interests of the U.S. in the Middle East.
If you want to understand the Western relationship with the Islamic world, you need to bear in mind this sort of Orientalist mystique that was developed in Europe, in Britain, and in France by intellectuals who were actually helping the British and French colonial regimes explain, rationalize, legitimate their empire in various parts of the world.
Innocence Abroad, Building America's New Empire in the Middle East, a lecture by Professor Douglas Little from Clark University. Tonight on Boston University's World of Ideas. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Secretary of State Colin Powell is disputing the assertion by the leaders of the House Intelligence Committee that the Bush administration relied on outdated, fragmentary intelligence that was replete with uncertainties in deciding to take military action against Iraq. Powell says the history of Saddam Hussein's behavior could not be ignored.
And to say that, well, since you don't have positive information or you don't have information that satisfies us, we should assume that all of these weapons are gone or they weren't there in the first place, defies the logic of the situation over the years and what we know about this regime.
Powell was interviewed on ABC's This Week. Iran's foreign minister says his country is determined to cooperate with the International Atomic Energy Agency. The comment came a day after President Bush and Russian President Vladimir Putin urged Iran to give up its suspected nuclear weapons program. NPR's Allison Aubrey has more.
Iran's foreign minister, Kamal Karazi, said his country is receptive to the idea of resuming talks with the United States. But speaking on ABC's This Week, Karazi said Iran does not want the Bush administration to interfere in its internal affairs.
To start any dialogue between Iran and the United States, this has to be based on mutual respect and equal footing. Otherwise, there is no meaning to have such a dialogue.
In two recent instances, the IAEA has found evidence that Iran is enriching uranium. Iran says its nuclear programs are strictly for the production of energy, but inspectors have set an October deadline for Iran to prove it's not developing nuclear weapons. Karazi said his country wants to make sure that cooperation with the IAEA will remove all suspicions. Allison Aubrey, NPR News, Washington.
The lights are back on in Italy after a massive power outage left almost the entire country without electricity overnight. Officials are still trying to determine the exact cause, as NPR's Nick Spicer reports from Paris.
The operator of France's power grid says the equivalent of two nuclear reactors' worth of electricity supply to Italy went offline last night. But the French say the first breakdowns came on power lines from Austria and Switzerland. At a little after 3 a.m. local time, electricity was cut off to all of Italy except for the island of Sardinia. 30,000 train passengers were stranded, and in Rome, tens of thousands were plunged into the dark during an all-night festival. Air travel was also disrupted. The surprise blackout follows recent power outages which hit Britain, then Sweden and Denmark. The French network operator says those events and the North American power outage last summer will need to be studied to understand what might have happened. Nick Spicer, NTR News, Paris.
Hurricane Juan is churning its way toward Canada. It's expected to make landfall in Nova Scotia this evening just at high tide. The storm has sustained winds of 100 miles an hour, but forecasters say it's expected to weaken as it hits colder waters just offshore. This is NPR News from Washington.
Good evening in Boston. I'm Gina Tempesta. A gorilla escaped its containment area at the Franklin Park Zoo in Boston this afternoon. Zoo officials say the gorilla that escaped today was Little Joe, the same 280-pound primate that escaped last month. He was on the loose for a while today before zoo staff and veterinarians sedated him. No other details are available, but a 2-year-old girl was reportedly injured. The Republican newspaper has filed a complaint with state police, alleging that a photographer was harassed after he took pictures of a police cruiser parked in a handicapped driver's area. The newspaper says that state trooper Patrick Moynihan followed photographer David Molnar after he took the pictures last week, then cited him for failing to signal and made an apparent threat against the newspaper. And the National Park Service will spend over $3 million, including $500,000 from the Massachusetts Grand Lodge of Freemasons, to rehabilitate the Bunker Hill Monument and Bunker Hill Museum. The monument is poorly ventilated in the summer, and the steps that lead to the top ice over in the winter due to moisture leaks. The $500,000 donation will be used to redesign the museum exhibits. The Constitution will likely begin its rehabilitation in 2004, and the completed target date is 2006. In the forecast, showers likely tonight with lows in the upper 50s. Tomorrow, partly sunny, a high around 70. And for Tuesday, partly sunny with highs in the mid-60s. Right now, it's 64 in Boston.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, MathWorks.com. By REMAX, serving commercial and residential real estate needs nationally and internationally. REMAX, addressing a variety of real estate requests. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, now in its 25th year. Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Tonight, we hear a lecture by Professor Douglas Little. Douglas Little is a professor of history, dean of the college, and associate provost at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts. His publications include American Orientalism, the United States and the Middle East since 1945, and Malevolent Neutrality, the United States, Great Britain, and the Origin of the Spanish Civil War. His lecture tonight is entitled Innocence Abroad, Building America's New Empire in the Middle East. The lecture was sponsored by Boston University's African American Studies program. Professor Little.
I thought what I would try to do is talk a little bit this afternoon about my book as a way of understanding where we are with American foreign policy in the Middle East with the Bush administration in the year 2003. And to do that, I wanted to loop back to the 19th century and America's first round of imperialism, because in a weird sort of way, it was my thinking about 19th century American history that helped put me on the road to doing the book I did and to be thinking about American foreign policy in the Middle East in the 21st century. And as I thought a little bit about how I would shape this lecture or this talk, and I thought a little bit about who had inspired me, I became convinced that it was Mark Twain. In fact, in the front of my book, the epigraph is from Mark Twain. And partly that's because Twain, of course, was a master of irony, and I'm fond of irony myself. I think there are a lot of ironies about American foreign policy in the Middle East in the 21st century. But Twain was also one of the first Americans to encounter the Middle East and then write a bestseller about it. He wasn't quite Tom Friedman, but he was sort of like that. He went off, as some of you may know, in 1867 as a reporter for a journal called the Alta California. And he booked passage on the SS Quaker City. He and about 125 other American pilgrims sailed east. I think it's wonderful that they sailed east instead of west through the Mediterranean, found themselves in the Holy Land. And Twain writes this hilarious, ironic account of this first American encounter with the Middle East in 1867. He publishes it in 1869 as a book called Innocence Abroad. I don't know if any of you have read Twain's Innocence Abroad. I hadn't read it. I knew about it, but I hadn't read it until about 15 years ago. And somebody put me onto it and said it would be worth taking a look at. And what he describes, I think, in the Innocence Abroad is really America's first encounter with cultural imperialism, or at least the first encounter with cultural imperialism in the Middle East. These pilgrims have in their heads images of what the Holy Land should be like, what Arabs should be like, what Jews should be like, what Christians should be like, most of it drawn from the Old and New Testament, and they arrive, and things, as you can imagine, are very different and very upsetting, and they respond in a kind of a typical American way, which is to kind of be pretty scornful and pretty critical of what they encounter, and Twain writes all of this down. Their illusions are dashed. They come home never again to set foot in the Middle East. Twain becomes a best-selling author on the basis of doing this travelogue. And the subtext there, I think, is cultural imperialism. The subtext is, I think, a vision of America as a city upon a hill. The Middle East is sort of a slum in the valley. And Twain is quite critical of his fellow Americans for developing that sort of view of the region. So anyway, that part of Twain inspired me a little bit in terms of his encounter with the Middle East. But there's more of Twain that I'm fond of. I'm fond of his book, The Gilded Age, published in 1873, because it was really the first account of the rapacious industrialization that swept the United States after the Civil War, and that became a central force, I think, behind American foreign policy and American expansion, transoceanic expansion, in the 1880s, the 1890s, and the early 21st century. So Twain is one of the first individuals to take a look at cultural imperialism. He's one of the first individuals in sort of journalistic fashion to write about the underside, the seamy side of America during the Gilded Age, and to talk a little bit about the way that American economic expansion would shape the political system in the U.S. and also would shape American foreign policy. I'm also fond of Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn, Twain's masterworks, because of what they tell us, I think, about the centrality of race in the American experience. Not that people were unaware of that before Twain wrote, of course, but he wrote in a vernacular and he made it accessible. And in the characters that he put together in his novels, Tom Sawyer and The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, you can begin to see, I think, how problematic race relations are in the United States. And it's my contention, and it's the contention of other historians as well, that when Americans travel abroad, they carry with them sort of mental images about what the right kind of race relation should be and what sort of racial hierarchy maybe there should be around the world. And Twain, in some sense, I think, is the father of that kind of analysis as well. But what really inspired me most about Twain, beyond The Innocents Abroad, was his career as an anti-imperialist in the late 1890s and the early 1900s. He was one of those people. It was a very, very strange set of bedfellows that included Andrew Carnegie and Jane Addams, who were opposed to America's splendid little war with Spain in 1898, not because maybe the Spaniards didn't deserve to be knocked into a cocked hat. Twain was enough of a pugnacious fellow maybe to believe that, but he was a little worried about what the consequences of America's involvement in the war with Spain would be. In particular, as you know, this gave the United States its first opportunity to build a formal empire, even though McKinley and others like to call it something other than an empire, in the Philippines, where, as some of you may know, the United States waged an anti-guerrilla war, a counterinsurgency campaign from 1899 to 1902 that cost the lives of somewhere around 200,000 Filipinos. And Twain was critical of that. He wrote essays that were critical of that. He poked fun at the sort of imperial mentality that was behind American foreign policy in this part of the world, and he made a name for himself as kind of a political critic and a political commentator in 1899 and 1900. At the time that he was developing his critique, there were a couple of other people who we would probably call action intellectuals today, who were developing a rationale for America's empire in the Far East, and really laying the groundwork for American foreign policy throughout most of the 20th century. And my favorite among them, not least because he's the grandson of David McCulloch's John Adams, is Brooks Adams, who actually wrote a book in 1893 or 1894 called The New Empire. And what Brooks Adams said, what John Adams's grandson said, was that it was time for the United States to take that leap from being a transcontinental to a transoceanic empire. The U.S. should do it in a place like the Caribbean. The U.S. should do it in a place like the Far East. Brooks Adams had really no interest in the Middle East. But the reasons that the United States should do it are pretty clear when you read through Brooks Adams' book, and you read between the lines for some of this, and you read just the lines for most of it. He's quite blunt about America's economic interest and the need to become engaged in world affairs as a way to keep the United States prosperous. This is a time when the U.S. is in a serious depression. We don't use the D word anymore. We use the R word, recession. We're certainly in a serious recession now. Whether it becomes something more than that, I guess, remains to be seen in 2003. Anyway, Brooks Adams talks about economic interest. He talks about the balance of power and America's responsibility, as he sees it. It's sort of a self-imposed or a self-assumed responsibility to inject the United States into this balance of power in East Asia, to prevent the Germans or the British or the French or the Italians or the Russians from practicing old-fashioned imperialism, and also to and also to open the door to American involvement in that part of the world. So those are two things that Brooks Adams is writing in his new book, New Empire, in counterpoint to Mark Twain, that he's very explicit about. Implicit in Brooks Adams' analysis, it seems to me, is racism or Anglo-Saxon sort of social Darwinistic view of the world in which the whites would be at the top and the peoples of color would be farther down that racial hierarchy. And from the standpoint of people like Brooks Adams, from the standpoint of people like Theodore Roosevelt, who, after all, remember, is one of the Rough Riders and an assistant secretary of the Navy and soon to be vice president of the United States in the year 1900, it's America's responsibility to export civilization, to lift these people, these Filipinos who were referred to in all sorts of derogatory ways that are, you know, not for polite company, that it's our job to lift them up and up and up until, as one of Brooks Adams' friends put it, lift them up and up and up until they're just like Kansas City. So there you go. So you've got sort of a new American empire emerging at the end of the 19th century. Its proponents, people like Brooks Adams, people like Alfred Thayer Mahan, people like Theodore Roosevelt, people like Henry Cabot Lodge Sr., are quite explicit in the economic rationale, the strategic rationale. The racial rationale is implicit. Twain doesn't like it, and he makes no bones about it. Twain is very critical, and I think as he looked forward to American foreign policy in the 20th century, and he thought about the consequences of America's new empire in East Asia and the Caribbean, he had to be looking back to the Innocents Abroad and sort of the cultural imperialism that he first saw when he set foot in the Holy Land in 1867, when he and the Quaker City passengers arrived. So Twain dies in 1910. At that point, the United States footprint in the Middle East is tiny. There really is no American footprint except for a few missionaries and a couple of diplomatic missions and some merchants, some trading firms. But over the course of the next century, obviously, the United States becomes deeply involved in that part of the world. And what I want to do is to talk a little bit about how some of those themes, economic interests, strategic interests, what I would call cultural imperialism or racism, play out in the shaping of American foreign policy mainly between 1945 and 2001. And then once I've done that, I want to take a look at what that tells us, what that heritage, what that history of American involvement in the Middle East down through 2001 may tell us about America's newer empire or newest empire in that part of the world that Condoleezza Rice and Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz and all of our other favorites inside the Bush administration are trying to develop. So let me spend a little bit of time talking about my book. You'll have to humor me. I mean, that's you know, it's like a baby, right? You know, it's not even a year old yet. So I want to tell you a little bit about what's in there and how it sort of lays the groundwork for maybe where we are in the 21st century, acknowledging my debt to Twain and his whole Innocents Abroad thesis. So let's begin by looking at the economic side of things, something that Professor Genzier is especially familiar with, although she's familiar with a lot of other things I'm going to say as well. In the beginning, I think it's fair to say there was oil, and that's what attracted the United States in a big way in the 20th century. Not that the missionaries weren't important, they were. Not that merchants weren't important, they were. Not that Henry Morgenthau going to the Ottoman court and kind of playing as though he were some high mucky muck, that was important as well. But the oil is what really begins to draw the United States into that part of the world in the 1930s and the 1940s. And in the beginning, it would be fair to say, I guess, with a bow to Charlie Wilson, Eisenhower's Secretary of Defense in the 1950s, what was good for Exxon was good for the United States and vice versa. The United States already had a full plate in the wake of World War II. The U.S. was involved in the reconstruction of Japan. The United States was involved in the U.S. government was involved in the reconstruction of Germany. The U.S. played a pretty heavy hand or used a pretty heavy hand in Latin America. to get involved in a political way or a diplomatic way in the Middle East was something that the Truman administration would have preferred not to do. And America's stake in Middle East oil kind of provided a really neat, informal backdoor way of the United States exercising influence in the region, getting some economic resources without having to invest large amounts of military power or diplomatic power in that part of the world. At this time, in the 1940s and the 1950s, the United States was actually self-sufficient in oil. And although we tend to forget it, the United States was a net exporter of oil until the late 1950s. But that doesn't mean that that huge treasure of oil beneath the sands of the Middle East wasn't important to American foreign policymakers, because, of course, Japan and Western Europe are not self-sufficient. And so as the U.S. looked at the situation in Middle East oil in the 1940s and the 1950s, there was real economic interest there, the sort of economic interest that Brooks Adams would have recognized, the sort of economic interest that Mark Twain would have recognized. But in the beginning, it was an economic interest that was more important to our allies in Western Europe and Japan than it was to the United States. And the way it worked with the oil companies was that the U.S. government was very good at pushing the door open. Sometimes this meant pushing the British or the French out of the way so that the U.S. oil companies would have a shot. Sometimes it meant overthrowing a government in Syria when they wouldn't let the U.S. oil companies build a pipeline across Syria. But the implementation of policy was by and large done by the oil companies down through the late 1950s into the 1960s, at least in the Arab part of the Middle East. And this was fine with the United States because American officials also were developing this special relationship with Israel. And the way that the policy worked out was that the U.S. could have a really tight political relationship with Israel, a really tight economic relationship with some of the Arab oil-producing states. You could go to Congress and get dollars to support American policy in Israel. You didn't have to do that in the Arab world because the oil companies had figured out a really nice way to channel revenues, royalties mainly, to the Arab oil states. And ultimately, once the U.S. moves into Iran in the late 1950s, into Iran as well, through some wiggling of the IRS code, et cetera, et cetera. So oil is important, and don't let anybody, Dick Cheney or anybody else, tell you it's not important. It was important in 1900. It was important in 1945. It was important in 1973. It's important now. What happened, of course, between the late 1950s and the end of the 20th century was that some things changed in terms of U.S. consumption patterns so that the U.S. was no longer self-sufficient in oil. The U.S. was no longer a net exporter of oil. As American automobiles got bigger in the 1960s and the 1970s, as the American population grew, as America's own oil supply was drawn down, the U.S. began to import larger and larger amounts of oil from overseas, and more of that oil came from the Middle East. And, of course, at just the key moment that the U.S. consumption was going up, OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, was established in 1960, became a pretty potent force in the 1970s, and began to assume control over the production of oil in the mid and late 1970s. And at this point, the oil companies had a hard choice to make. They could have tried to fight OPEC, it seems to me, and perhaps that would have been good for the American national interest, or maybe it would not have. But the oil companies quickly concluded that they could make a pretty profit if they were just to become a marketing outlet for OPEC oil. And to a very great degree, that's what the oil companies did in the 1970s and the 1980s. And, of course, the U.S. government then was at the mercy of OPEC, which now controlled price and controlled output. And this produced a couple of energy crises. It produced some inflation. It produced not a particularly good situation for the United States down through the early 1980s. The economy rebounds in the mid-1980s. And then at the end of the decade, when Saddam Hussein and Iraq invade Kuwait, you have George Bush Sr. and his Secretary of State, Jim Baker, being very explicit about the importance of oil in the making of American foreign policy. That four-letter word, jobs, is one that Jim Baker used in the fall of 1990. In a couple of speeches that George Bush Sr. made in September and October of 1990, he said explicitly, we can't let Saddam Hussein get control over Kuwait's oil, because if he gets Kuwait's oil and he's got Iraq's oil, he's going to have close to 25% of the world's supply. And that's a problem. So anyway, economic interest from the 19th century to the 21st century, there's some continuity there And oil is at the center of that. And I've tried to make that case in my book. The whole idea of sort of America's special relationship with the Holy Land, or America's special relationship with Israel, or America's special relationship with Palestine in the biblical sense, is also, I think, pretty consistent. One of the interesting things, if you look at the early supporters of Zionism in the United States, the non-Jewish supporters of Zionism in the United States, they tended to be Christian fundamentalists who saw kind of redemption, the book of Revelation and all of that, coming into being in the Holy Land. And so they're supportive. They go to Congress and lobby hard in the 1890s and even into the early 20th century to get Congress to pass a resolution endorsing the creation of some sort of Jewish homeland in Palestine, because it's a biblical, you know, it's the fulfillment of a biblical prophecy. Well, if that sounds a lot like the Christian fundamentalists in the early 21st century, I'm sorry, but that's another example of the kind of continuity that we can see. But bear in mind that it's more than just domestic politics. There's more going on there than just election day vote counting and influence buying, or whatever you want to call it. A third piece that is not going to come as any surprise to you is the whole Cold War dimension to American foreign policy in the Middle East. And there, the United States was involved in trying to contain the Soviet Union. Several people sitting in the room are probably young enough not to have remembered when the Cold War was running hot, right? Some of you are, you can remember, how many of you can remember the Berlin Wall coming down? The younger, I mean, obviously, well, those of us who haven't lost our minds can remember it, who are old enough. But in any case, the Cold War was a big deal. And keeping the Soviets out of the Middle East in this zero-sum game was a big deal for the U.S. And what happened in the Middle East was that the principal Western bulwark in the region, the British Empire, began a slow-motion collapse. Some would say in 1919, others would say 1945, and that collapse accelerates in the 1950s, in the 1960s, in the 1970s, and the U.S. is sort of faced with this problem that you want to keep stability in the region because of the oil, because Israel's there. You want to keep the Soviets out. You've got this great British Empire that could do that job, and gradually it becomes attenuated. Gradually it becomes weaker and weaker. The British government makes a series of decisions to pull out, first from Greece in 1947, then in 1956 in the wake of the Suez Crisis, sort of a parting of the ways between the United States and Britain, where, in a way, Britain accepts its status as a junior partner in the region with the U.S. as a senior partner. And then when Britain can't even really afford junior partner status in the late 60s and the early 70s, it scuttles. It scuttles the empire east of Suez. It pulls out of Aden in 1968 at the very tip of the Arabian Peninsula, and it pulls out of the Persian Gulf and creates the United Arab Emirates in 1971. And then for the U.S., the question is, with Britain gone, what are you going to do to contain the Soviet Union? What are you going to do to ensure stability in the region and avoid bringing American troops into play? Because, after all, this is a time when there are almost 600,000 U.S. troops in Vietnam. And as the U.S. looks at what it could do in the region in the wake of Britain's departure, in the wake of, in the midst of America's deep involvement in Vietnam, the U.S. comes up with the brilliant idea of partnering with some regional proxies who, on a good day, can provide some stability, Western access to Middle Eastern oil, and everybody will live happily ever after. And, of course, over the long run, that was a pretty ill-advised policy. The first example of that policy coming into play came in Iran, where there was a nationalist government that came to power in the early 1950s, tried to nationalize the oil industry, did nationalize the oil industry, which was British-owned and operated. MI6 and the CIA went in, reversed that, deposed the nationalist government, and brought back the Shah of Iran, the same Shah who went into exile in 1979 and died in exile in 1980, brought him back as sort of he wasn't a puppet. The Shah wasn't a puppet. He was a pro-Western imperialist himself in the Gulf. And he came back to power in 1953, and he was there until 1979. The U.S. ultimately paid a big price for having brought him back to power, because when his regime collapsed in 1979, the principal bill of attainder that was delivered against the United States by the Ayatollah Khomeini, who succeeded the Shah, was 1953, an American intervention, an American manipulation, an American anti-communism leading to this autocratic government that was not popular with the people. So that's the story of containment in Iran. Containment elsewhere in the Middle East is equally difficult for the United States. In Iran, it was containing nationalism. The fellow who was overthrown in 1953, a fellow named Mossadegh, was not a communist. He was a nationalist. In Afghanistan in the late 1970s and the early 1980s, it was literally containing the Red Army. And, of course, we all know how that one played out. The Red Army did roll into Kabul on Christmas Eve 1979. We now know that there had been this sort of covert war going on in Afghanistan in 1978 and 1979, long before the Soviet Red Army rolled in. There was an insurrection underway. And once the Red Army rolled into Kabul in 1979, the Carter administration began to look around to see who they could find as a bulwark or a counterbalance to the Red Army, and came up with the brilliant idea of aiding the Afghan Mujahideen. And ultimately, by 1986, 1987, the U.S. CIA, the Reagan administration, are giving Stinger missiles to the Mujahideen. We now are pretty sure that one of the people who helped build the infrastructure for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan was Osama bin Laden. And we know that there was close to $3 billion in aid, half of it Saudi and half of it U.S., that went into Afghanistan to help the Mujahideen in their effort to defeat the Red Army. That happened, of course, in 1989, but it's one of those moments where you know, the old line, be careful what you wish for, is worth remembering. Because in the wake of that victory over the Soviet Union, and the more we can tell from the Soviet archives, the clearer it becomes that Afghanistan really was the final nail in the coffin for the Soviet regime. The U.S. referred to it in the Reagan years as Soviet Union's Vietnam. Afghanistan is the Soviet Union's Vietnam. The upshot of that was a Mujahideen civil war inside Afghanistan that opened the door to the Taliban in 1996, and we all know what happened after that by 2001. The final irony in terms of this containment policy: we contain nationalism by bringing the Shah back, we contain Soviet expansion by dealing with the Mujahideen, we try to contain the Islamic threat represented by the Ayatollah Khomeini in 1979-1980 by turning to, you guessed it, Saddam Hussein, a secular radical who, as one of Reagan's policymakers put it in the early 1980s, actually the comment came at the end of the decade after Saddam had invaded Kuwait, Laurie Milroy, who was just published a new book on the left-wing conspiracy to discredit the Bush administration's foreign policy in the Middle East. She's always been a little odd, I think, in my estimation. She did some interviewing with Reagan people about U.S. relationship with Iraq in the 1980s. And she said to one of Reagan's National Security Council staffers who ran the Iraq desk in the White House, didn't you guys know that Saddam was bad news? Didn't you know that he was likely to do something crazy like this? And the response was, well, listen, remember, the Iran-Iraq war, we saw Saddam Hussein as the lesser of two evils. We were using Ba'athism to contain Islamic fundamentalism or Islamic radicalism. Did we know he was an SOB? Yes, we knew he was an SOB, but he was our SOB. Honest to God, that's what they said. He was an SOB, but he was our SOB. So it seems to me that sort of logic is at play here, and it's one of those, you know, Middle Eastern proverbs, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. That's sort of the way you make policy. You look who your enemy is, you find out who the enemy of your enemy is, and that person is your friend, and sometimes that turns out to be the Mujahideen. Sometimes that turns out to be Saddam Hussein. On a good day, it turns out to be the Shah, but even, you know, the Shah had many bad days. So, in any case, in terms of the underpinnings of American interests in the Middle East, there's oil. That's no surprise to you. There's Israel. That's no surprise to you. There's the Cold War. There's containment, and that shouldn't be a surprise to you. But the more I've thought about the U.S. relationship with this part of the world, and the more I thought about the trajectory of that connection between the Middle East and the United States, the more I became convinced that at bottom, culture was the key factor. And as I began to pull the book project together, I read for the second time. The first time was really tough going. The second time was a little less tough going. Edward Said's book, Orientalism. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with that book, but it really, even 25 years after it was published, it's still a very good read, and it's so evocative. And some of the things that we sort of almost take for granted now, 25 years later, we have to remember what a big splash it made when he put forward this argument. But basically what Said, who is actually a professor of literature at Columbia University, a Palestinian American, what he basically says is that if you want to understand the Western relationship with the Islamic world, and really with all of Asia, you need to bear in mind this sort of Orientalist mystique that was developed in Europe, in Britain and in France, by intellectuals who were actually helping the British and French colonial regimes explain, rationalize, legitimate their empire in various parts of the world. And of course, the narrative that is developed here is that the Muslim world is decadent, it's backward, it's inferior, these people are wogs, they are badly in need of our help, and it's our job to civilize them, and to quote one of Brooks Adams' friends, to lift them up and up and up until they're just like Manchester or Lyon or whatever it would be. You know, pick your city. So I read Said's book, and he's got the last quarter of the book is actually a meditation on American foreign policy with some unkind things to say about Henry Kissinger, which in my book always is a good thing. Although Kissinger's mellowed a little bit, I guess, in his old age. So I began to wonder a little bit about how Orientalism, this sort of demonization of that part of the world, this sense that Arabs and Muslims are different from us, but not only are they different from us, they're inferior to us in all sorts of cultural, political, economic ways, how that might have influenced American foreign policy. And then there was that epiphany, that seminal moment. I came in a movie theater. My daughter was present. I took her to see the Disney classic Aladdin in 1992. Now, have any of you seen Aladdin? The original, before Disney did the video, they had to do a little video adjusting before they could sell it in the home video market. But it's you know, at one level, it's this magnificent Disney animated classic, the tale of Jasmine and Aladdin. It's a love story and all of that. But it begins with this song that is crooned by a character who really is a Saddam Hussein lookalike, swarthy, accented, dark, turbaned, menacing. And the punchline was, it's called Arabian Nights. Oh, I come from a land, from a faraway place where the caravan camels roam, where they cut off your ear if they don't like your face. It's barbaric, but hey, it's home. So I, of course, noticed that when I was sitting there with my daughter, and she watches the film. And as we walk out, I said, Allison, what did you think of the film? And she looked at me and said, do they really cut off your ear if they don't like your face? And I thought, wow, you know, stereotypes are dangerous things. And, you know, W was a little boy once upon a time. In fact, he may still be a little boy. Who knows? So these, I hope I haven't offended anybody, but that's okay, too. So I began to think about stereotypes. And when you look back at American popular culture, the stereotypes are there in abundance. You can go back to The Innocents Abroad. You can go back to Twain and see the stereotypes. Innocents Abroad is full of stereotypes that Twain is offering in an ironic way. But I don't think most Americans read it as irony. They read it as an accurate depiction of these, you know, beggars and thieves and Alibabas who were populating the various spots that Twain and his pals stopped in 1867, and they read it as sort of a horror story. Certainly in the 20th century, the stereotypes are there. One of the things I took a look at was National Geographic magazine, for example, which was in the 1920s and 1930s one of the top five selling magazines in the United States, and I think it still is in terms of circulation up there in the top 20. And the depiction of the Middle East in the pages of National Geographic was something straight out of Said's Orientalism. And there it is on your coffee table or in your living room, and you're 3 or 4 or 5 years old, or maybe you're 12 or 13 years old, or maybe you're 20 or 25 or 30 years old, or maybe you're older than that, and you read it and you see it. And what you see is sort of a backward, decadent, Arabs, Middle Easterners. Once Israel is created, the juxtaposition is really jarring because by the 1950s and the 1960s, Israel is represented as very Western, as it was and is. And the juxtaposition of sort of Oriental culture, Arab culture, with Israeli culture, which is modern, and in a couple of the stories in National Geographic, is likened to the culture of Southern California, not Northern California, but Southern California. You begin to see how Americans would separate the sheep from the goats as they looked at this part of the world. So I began to think about stereotypes. I began to look at popular films. I began to look at Pulp Fiction. And what I saw was what I call American Orientalism. And, of course, the hard part there is connecting that to policy. It's really easy, especially prior to about 1965 or so, to see the stereotypes, and they're there unabashedly, unashamedly, sort of in a derogatory fashion, depicting Middle Eastern peoples in a pretty unfriendly way. How do you connect that to policy? That's the rub. And my response when I get pressed on that, and you may press me on that in the Q&A session as well, is to say, well, I think that all those Orientalist images predispose Americans and their leaders to be suspicious of, skeptical of, Muslims and Arabs, predispose them to be favorably inclined towards Israel. Think back to juxtapose in your mind's eye Exodus. Have any of you seen Exodus with Paul Newman, 1960, I guess, Leon Uris's? And juxtapose that with Arnold Schwarzenegger in True Lies. Any of you seen that? When I came home in shock from having taken my daughter to Aladdin and told my son, who's older, I said, this was awful. I feel like I've, you know, warped your sister. He said, if you think Aladdin was bad, you should see True Lies. And he wasn't talking about Schwarzenegger's acting. He was talking about the Crimson Jihad that's out there trying to fly a plane into a skyscraper in Miami or set off a nuclear weapon in Miami. And, of course, the ultimate irony here is that when you demonize people, sometimes they begin to behave in demonic fashions, and I think there's been a bit of that that's gone on. So for me, the key ingredient beyond the economic and Israel and containment was cultural. It's this Orientalism, this use of stereotypes, and it played itself out in a really interesting way and in the end a pretty damaging way for American national interest in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s in the Middle East, because as American policymakers became convinced that these folks were backward, that they couldn't run a two-car funeral, that they really were incapable of taking care of themselves politically, economically, and culturally, we need to help them change, along comes modernization theory in the late 1950s and early 1960s, and you've got these action intellectuals saying what we need is modernization, and we need reform, and we need development. And American policymakers say, this sounds right to us. Here we are, we're back to Brooks Adams, or we're back to Woodrow Wilson. We need to remake the world in our own image. These people want to be just like us. Let's help them do that. And they go into Iraq in the late 1950s and talk about reform and that sort of thing. And the next thing you know, the Iraqi monarchy is overthrown, not just because Britain and the U.S. are preaching modernization theory, but partly because of that. Having seen what happens in Iraq in 1958, and having looked at this huge pool of oil that sits beneath Libya, the U.S. government says, if we don't get King Idris to reform his regime and to modernize, we're going to have a revolution. So sure enough, in the early 1960s, they tell King Idris, who's at this point about 70-some-odd years old, what you need to do is modernize, you need to reform. And as that dynamic plays itself out, there are people who are listening, and Gaddafi shows up one September morning in 1969. And to a degree, you can say the same thing about Iran, that this sort of Orientalist model in America's mind's eye, we need to help these people become more like us. They're backward, they're decadent, they're untrustworthy. Let's help them become more like us. We encouraged the Shah to do that. The Shah wanted to do it for his own reasons. We didn't hold a gun to his head. He was eager to do it. He unleashes something called the White Revolution in the 1960s. And by the end of the 1970s, the White Revolution becomes a real rallying point for the Ayatollah Khomeini, who says, what's all this I hear about a White Revolution? White Revolution or Red Revolution? Red Revolution is Bolshevism. White Revolution is sort of top-down revolution. The Ayatollah Khomeini says that this White Revolution is going to make the average Iranian rank in this grand scheme of things about the level of your average dog. And it's America's fault for encouraging the Shah to do it. And the Shah's big crime in the Ayatollah Khomeini's eyes is to betray Islam and to sort of sell that Islamic tradition for this mess of modernization pottage. And so there's the overthrow of the regime in 1979, and the Islamic Republic comes to power. So culture, both in terms of stereotypes and in terms of this commitment to modernization or globalization, I think is really the key for understanding how the United States got to be in the situation that it's in the Middle East by the 1990s, which then brings me to some conclusions that I would draw, I guess, about where we are in 2003 and where we're likely to be, unfortunately, in 2004, 5, 6, 7 for the next little while, because I do think that there's continuity. But what's a little scary for me is to think a little bit about what's new. So let me close with sort of an assessment of what I think is new, and then maybe a comment or two about trying to answer the question of what that means for relations between the U.S. and the Muslim world. There's several things that are new about what I'm calling nation-building Crawford style, and that are scary. The scariest thing, I think, and the thing that worries me most, is the new national security doctrine that the Bush administration unveiled just about a year ago. And it's now called the Bush Doctrine. We're pretty sure that it did come out of Don Rumsfeld's Pentagon, and he was the key mover and shaker on it. This is the one that legitimates the idea of preemptive war. And the argument's a pretty simple one. No more September 11th. We were caught with our guard down. Osama bin Laden did a terrible thing to the U.S. I think everybody sitting in this room would agree with that. And then the next step is never again. And the way you prevent that is to preempt. And, of course, preemptive war is what the war against Iraq was all about. It was a war designed to prevent Saddam Hussein from getting weapons of mass destruction. It's unclear that he really had any intention, at least in recent years, to do that. But the idea that he might be a threat, that he might turn such weapons over to Osama bin Laden, becomes the rationale for American military intervention. And if you read that document, it's available on the White House website. Have a look at it. It's not just Iraq that Rumsfeld and his pals are talking about. It's the axis of evil and beyond that. It could be applicable anywhere. And, of course, the scary part about it is not that powers haven't preempted before. You know, on occasion, one could argue that the U.S. has even done a bit of that. But the danger is, what happens if, say, India decides to preempt because they're convinced that Pakistan is about to do something with its nuclear weapons, or vice versa? So that's new. That's a change in American policy in the Middle East. In a way, it's a reaction to, an overreaction to what I've called in my book the Vietnam Syndrome, where the idea that U.S. intervention is anywhere is a bad idea. Suddenly, in the world, strange world of George W. Bush, American intervention everywhere is a good idea, and preemptive strikes are something you can contemplate. Second thing that worries me a little bit, and it's actually very closely related to the first, but I can't resist telling you this story. Did any of you see the piece in the Washington Post and then in the New York Times about the Pentagon watching the Battle of Algiers, Pontecorvo's classic 1965 movie about this urban guerrilla war? One of the guys who helped ensure that the Pentagon would view the Battle of Algiers is this guy at the Naval War College named Thomas Barnett. And I made the mistake of going down to the Naval War College to give a talk similar to this one this past May, and he was there. He's an associate professor of strategic studies, and he's assigned to Rumsfeld's office in the Pentagon. I thought about bringing my PowerPoint presentation today because I got a lot of good Orientalist slides, but I thought that wouldn't be a good idea. I had my PowerPoint presentation with me at the Naval War College. This guy had a PowerPoint presentation on steroids with sound effects that sounded like cruise missiles coming in, and he really believes that this new technology, this sort of smart bombs and smart missiles and all of that, is going to change the face of warfare. And, of course, this was prior to getting mired down in the quagmire in June and July and August. I don't know exactly what he's saying now, except that he's suggesting that having a look at the Battle of Algiers along with his PowerPoint presentation might be useful. And it's true. I'm envious. My articles tend to appear in places like Diplomatic History. His article called The Pentagon's New Map appeared in Esquire in April. So, but you know, what can I say? But there is this sort of new tactical approach to warfare linked to preemptive war that's a little frightening. Another concern, I think, is what the press is now calling the reverse domino theory. Paul Wolfowitz, who is one of the action intellectuals inside Rumsfeld's Pentagon, seems to be the principal proponent of this argument that George W. Bush, at least until very recently, seemed to believe that one of the principal reasons you go into Iraq is that Iraq is the first democratic domino to fall. Liberate Iraq, export democracy to Iraq. Seems like a piece of cake, right? A cakewalk. When that happens, can Syria or Iran or North Korea or the Palestinian Authority or any other, you know, take your pick of autocratic governments anywhere in the world, can they be far behind? It really appears that Wolfowitz and his pals believe this. But there are saner people in the U.S. government, most of them in the State Department, who disagree and who made the point, and I'm sure they're saying, I told you so right now. In February of 2003, when Wolfowitz began to unveil this argument, the State Department said, this is not going to work. You know, it's a cockamamie argument. You know, what have you been smoking? This is not a good approach to that part of the world. So that's the reverse domino theory is new. How long it lasts, I guess, will be open to question. And then finally, I'm making my way through a really interesting book by Noah Feldman, who is an interesting fellow. He's trained in Middle Eastern studies at Oxford. He was a Rhodes Scholar. He's also got a law degree, I believe. He's clerked for a U.S. District Court judge, and he's now, I think, in the law school faculty at Columbia University. And he's been picked out by the Bush administration to go write the Constitution, if Ahmad Chalabi will let him do it, for free Iraq. And I actually, I'm not all the way through the book, but I actually am heartened a little bit by this book, because on the one hand, he's sort of a Wilsonian. It's called After Jihad, and but the point he makes that I think is a central point that I hope the Bush administration picks up on, and that he remembers as he works to draft this Constitution, is that Islam and democracy are not inimical. It's not... You know, there's no reason why you can't have democracy in the Islamic world. And he says that. He says you have to be prepared to deal with the consequences. You have to be prepared to deal with, say, Algeria in 1990, 1991, and allow the democratic process to play itself out rather than sanctioning a military confiscation of the ballot boxes. But as I think about what may have happened in that part of the world, however sophisticated Noah Feldman may be, the fact that he's fluent in Arabic is going to give him some access to the Islamic culture that folks like myself who don't won't have. There is a danger, I think, that we're going to see a MacArthur for Mesopotamia here, in the sense that Douglas MacArthur goes in and remakes Japan. I don't know. I suppose that's probably a good thing when you think back of what the old Japan looked like prior to 1945. But it was a long project. And I think if we do get a MacArthur for Mesopotamia, we're going to be faced with a long haul and a long battle. So let me close with maybe take a look at a poem, a really prophetic poem that was written by Ali Ahmed Said, who is known throughout the Arab world as Adonis. He's sort of the informal poet laureate of the Arab world. And I came across this poem. It was actually excerpted in a Foreign Affairs article, of all places. A guy named, was it Duran? Mike Scott Duran? The guy at Princeton wrote an article about September the 11th, published in the spring of 2002. And he quotes from the poem. And I actually read the whole poem after I had actually read Billy Collins' poem, The Names, which is this beautiful, heartbreaking poem about September the 11th by our poet laureate. And I won't quote from that, but it's a heartbreaking poem for Americans. And then you read this whole poem from Adonis, and the title of the poem is The Funeral of New York. And I'll just read you about a minute and a half's worth. Picture the earth as a pear or breast. Between such fruits and death survives an engineering trick. New York. Call it a city on four legs heading for murder while the drowned already moan in the distance. New York is a woman holding, according to history, a rag called liberty with one hand and strangling the earth with the other. New York is Madison and Park Avenues and Harlem. It is laziness that looks like work and work that looks like laziness. Hearts are sponges, hands are swollen reeds. Out of an empire state of dirt and garbage rises the stink of history. This was written in 1971. In Pittsburgh, Baltimore, Cambridge, Ann Arbor, Manhattan, the United Nations, Princeton, and Philadelphia, I saw the Arab map. It resembled a mare shuffling on, dragging its history like saddlebags, nearing its tomb in the pitch of hell, discovering the chemistry of Kazakhstan and Afro-Asia. New York, you will find in my land a bed and silence, a chair, a head, the sail of day and night, the stone of Mecca, and the waters of the Tigris. In spite of all this, you pant in Palestine and Hanoi, east and west. You contend with people whose only history is fire. And then this is the real scary part. Let statues of liberty crumble. Out of corpses now sprout nails in the manner of flowers. An eastern wind uproots tents and skyscrapers with its wings. In the west, a second alphabet is born, and the sun's mother is a tree in Jerusalem. I write in flames. And then at the end of the poem, he actually takes aim at the American century. It's an interesting poem. He's carrying on a dialogue with a bunch of people, including Walt Whitman. And so he says, I rise in the morning and awaken Whitman. Walt Whitman, I see letters careening toward you down the streets of Manhattan. Each letter carries cats and dogs. To cats and dogs, the 21st century. To people, extermination in this, the American century. Whitman, a clock announces time to New York like garbage thrown to a woman who is nine parts ashes. A clock announces time where Pavlov experiments with people in the system of New York. A clock announces time while a letter comes from the East written in a child's blood. I scan it until the child's doll becomes a cannon and a rifle. Corpses in their streets make sisters of Hanoi, Jerusalem, and Cairo. And then Whitman, let it be our turn now. Let it be our turn now. So you got this real clash of cultures. Some folks in that part of the world really have some issues with us. And I think we need to be able to kind of listen to what they're saying. They need to be able to listen to what we're saying. And the more that we get wedded to the stereotypes of Orientalism, the more we get wedded to this sort of muscular policy of military intervention, the less likely I think we are to be able to hear what others are saying, and the less likely they are to hear what we're saying. And I think that would bode very poorly for America and its adventure in the Middle East.
Professor Douglas Little from Clark University, speaking on Innocence Abroad, Building America's New Empire in the Middle East. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Largie with help from Tim Skog and John Perotti. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us.
Tomorrow, tune in at noon to WBUR's News Magazine, Here and Now. We'll have all the latest news, and will there ever be a prescription drug plan from Congress? Don't count on it anytime soon. We'll try to simplify the snags. And we meet Jhumpa Lahiri, an acclaimed short story writer who's written her first novel. I'm Bill Delaney. Join Robin Young and me for Here and Now, tomorrow at noon on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
This is WBUR. Coming up ahead at 10 o'clock after the news, it's BBC Assignment. On behalf of everyone here at WBUR, thank you.